Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had a very restful, long holiday weekend. Well, there are just 3 days left in 2014. In this hour, we speak with a man who had a remarkably good 2014, the head of the Rosetta Space Mission. That's the mission that put a lander on a comet earlier this year. Plus, we've got some historical criticism this hour of the new movie Selma, open now in limited release. And we're asking you all this hour for the story behind your passwords. How do you choose your passwords? How do you remember them? What do they say about you? Now, don't give away any secrets, but do give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. But we begin this hour with the tragedy out of Southeast Asia, where another airliner has gone missing. Officials say they believe an Air Asia jet carrying 162 people is at the bottom of the sea. The jet lost contact with ground controllers off the coast of Borneo early on Sunday. It had departed from Surabaya, Indonesia, and was heading towards Singapore. About 40 minutes after departure, Flight 8501 vanished from radar screens. Malaysia, Singapore, and Australia are assisting Indonesia in search efforts, and officials are investigating whether poor weather could have contributed to the flight's disappearance. Air Asia is a relatively young airline, and it had a perfect safety record before this incident. And CEO Tony Fernandez said the company will make adjustments as necessary in the aftermath of the crisis.
We don't really want to speculate until we find the aircraft. We know what went wrong, then we'll look into it and see, you know, what we need to improve, if we need to improve. But it's speculation at the moment, so it's premature to talk at the moment.
Thomas Fuller is a correspondent for our partner in the New York Times, and he's in Jakarta. Thomas, welcome.
Hi.
Give us a sense of how this tragedy is being digested there in Jakarta. Obviously, a terrible occurrence, but the third Malaysian jetliner to go down over the last year.
Well, I think there's a sense across Southeast Asia that this is uncanny, and that three times in a single year is you know, very unusual. I think people are just stunned by it.
Stunned is not surprising, Thomas Fuller, but I wonder if there's a sense of frustration or anger around what's become kind of a pattern, even if the individual crashes are probably coincidental.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of why me. I mean, you know, Malaysia is a, you know, fairly small, obscure country. Indonesia is a large country, but this is not, you know, a part of the world that gets in the headlines too often. I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people just wondering why, you know, lightning has struck so many times in the same place. It doesn't make sense to them. This is a part of the world where people are sort of naturally superstitious, and I think that's, you know, self-reinforcing.
What is the sense of how good of a job government officials, aviation officials are doing in disseminating the information that they do have?
Well, I mean, one thing about having this happen, you know, before is that sadly, this is something that's been practiced. So, you know, I think the responders that went out yesterday looking for the AirAsia jet know the drill. And so I from that perspective, you know, I think it's been a little smoother than what we saw in March with the Malaysian Airlines, you know, disappearance. We've had people who maybe you could call it sort of an accelerated response. It hasn't. There still has been some delays, and people are still, you know, figuring out as they go along. But I would you know, definitely say that people are drawing from the experience of what happened in March.
And Thomas Fuller, before we let you go, have there been any loud calls for reform, at least on the regulatory level among safety officials? If these types of crashes were happening in the United States, I think it's safe to say that a lot of people would be bearing down on the FAA. Does a similar thing go on there?
Well, there are a couple things. One is this is happening in Indonesia, and previously it was in Malaysia. So you have different constituencies. But also, I think the circumstances are really different. I mean, they're both treated as flukes in different ways. I mean, the first time you had very clear weather. This time it's in the middle of the monsoon, and weather seems to be a factor, whereas in the, you know, the first time it's more foul play, that theories that people are kicking around. So, you know, are people pressing for new technology? In aircraft and new technologies on the ground? I think that's more sort of a conversation among the experts and among, you know, in the aviation industry.
Thomas Fuller is a correspondent with our partner, The New York Times, and he's with us from Jakarta. Thomas, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
With me now in the studio is Barbara Peterson. She's senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Barbara, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Now, MH370 had a lot of unknowns and a lot of mysteries, apparently because its change of course took it over parts of the ocean that are not terribly well covered by satellite and not covered at all by radar. This is a different case, right? I mean, that section of the Java Sea is heavily radared, as I understand it, very heavy traffic area, lots of planes, lots of ships, shallow water, a big corridor, right?
Exactly. It's one of the busiest corridors in that region. But initially, after MH370 disappeared, the search was conducted fairly close to where the last communication had been. So it was a while before people realized that, wait a minute, the plane continued to fly for hours. So, yes, this is quite different. The pilot did not send out any distress call, but there was severe bad weather in the region. So we know that for sure. We know that he did request to go to a higher altitude. However, that type of thunderstorm can be very high. It's almost impossible to fly over it because it is so high. So it was just an unfortunate maybe confluence of events, which is typically how a lot of accidents unfold. It's usually not one single cause. It's a series of events that unfortunately line up in the wrong way.
Cascading series of events. And what about distress calls? What about calls after the request to deviate from automated parts of the plane that you might expect? There was nothing like that?
Well, they're still actually analyzing some of the data that they've gotten from radar. And they are finding out that it looks like what happened was that the plane may have stalled. Apparently, according to one report, the airspeed that they were able to detect in the latest reading was very, very slow for an aircraft. I mean, an aircraft flying at 36,000 feet should not be flying, you know, at around under 200 miles an hour, apparently. So that is one report. It has not been confirmed, I should say. And in fact, one of the troubling things right now is that in the vacuum of not having that actual data from the plane, the black box recorders, which are probably somewhere underneath the ocean, according to the Indonesian authorities, we really are just left with speculating until they find something tangible.
This is three losses in a year, and related or not, the accidents or shootdowns may be, this is now a pattern that's developed in Malaysia that they have to deal with.
Yes, it is a huge blow for the Malaysian aviation industry. However, this is just, I think, an unfortunate coincidence. There really is no single thing that links these three terrible tragedies, except, of course, that they all relate back to Malaysia's airlines. But other than that, the circumstances of each of these events is completely different. So, I would caution people not to jump to any conclusions.
Does it raise important questions, at least about preventative safety in the Malaysian air industry, whether it's pilot screening, mechanical, all of the things that our FAA does? I know Malaysia has an FAA of its own. Of course, they must. But doesn't it raise important questions about how they regulate their industry if they're losing planes at this rate?
Yes, it does. And in fact, each accident, of course, can provide lessons to hopefully prevent them in the future. After Air France 447 went down in the Atlantic in 2009, there was an emphasis again on training pilots to fly in and around this type of severe weather that apparently could have also been a factor in this one. So each one, of course, can provide lessons. And again, with MH370, the focus has been on flight tracking. And even just measures such as having an ejectable black box. So if a plane hits water, it would automatically eject, and then it would be found pretty rapidly. Something like that, that's been kicking around for a while. It wouldn't be very expensive, but the industry has resisted it because of the cost.
So that people aren't hunting black boxes at the bottom of the ocean as opposed to floating on the surface.
Exactly.
Well, lots of questions around the safety of Malaysian aviation, but more urgently, locating Air Asia Flight 8501 disappeared over the Java Sea over the weekend. Barbara Peterson, senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. Thank you.
Thank you.
The modern-day password, we're supposed to remember dozens of them. It can be a confusing and a revealing topic.
What's the combination? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5?
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage.
So many resets, so many characters, so many potentially senior moments. And of course, simplifying the whole ordeal can lead to the worst result of all, getting your information stolen. So, where does it all end?
Okay, what's the password?
You got it.
Got what?
The password.
Password is what?
Exactly.
The password is exactly?
No, it's...
Hold it. Slow down.
Points to anyone who can name that movie. But beyond the pain and grief, some might say there's a certain poetic beauty in how much a password can reveal about one's true self.
This is even more concise than haiku. It's often 6-10 characters long, and yet in there it's like a clown car. You open up the door and an impossible amount pours out.
Ian Urbina of the New York Times thought about passwords a lot for the Times Magazine a few weeks back, and he spoke with us about it, but we asked you how you got the passwords that are in your lives, what they say about you. It's kind of a radio Rorschach test.
Hi, this is Ken from Elmont, Long Island. When I choose a password, I use the first letter in a memorable phrase. For example, E-D-I-E-W-I-G-B-A-B, which could be changed to every day in every way I get better and better. No one will ever figure that out. No computer program will ever figure that out. Good luck with choosing your own password.
Hi, my name is Josh from Akron, Ohio. My passwords have always been an ongoing conversation with myself. It started when I made my first password into a statement and then the following one into a response and so on and so forth. For years now, it's been interesting to go back and look at what's been going on in my life based on what my password is.
There you go. Josh gets it. The password as biography. Now, a lot of you texted us as well from Oklahoma City. I've had 98 cats and they all revolve around their names and a certain series of numbers. From Northampton, Massachusetts, I have one password that is the name of a not very well-known local hooker from the 1800s. And a lot of you said pop culture was your go-to password creator.
Hi, this is Nick from Portland, Oregon. I tend to use decade-old phone numbers or addresses from my past. I even use phone numbers from old television shows.
555-0199.
Here's the number.
It's 555-7219.
Would you get me New York City, please? 212-555-6432.
Just call me at 555-0118 and ask for Dr. Fields.
And finally, some of you out there made it seem like your password protection strategy lies somewhere between Fort Knox and Edward Snowden's inbox.
Hi, this is Jerome from Florence, South Carolina, and there's definitely a system for choosing passwords. And of course, mine has 5 very components and 4 changeable levels with 3 different levels of security, and I'm the only one that knows what the components are.
Well, Jerome, thank you for that personal cryptography. Jerome is the human enigma machine, apparently. Tell us how you create your passwords and what they say about you, 8778MYTAKE, or tweet us uncryptically at The Takeaway. Well, New York Times reporter Ian Urbina hates all his digital passwords, too. But he's come to realize that they're a lot more than just simple little digital nuisances. More often than not, our passwords are little tiny biographies. They tell a story about us. It's a topic he wrote about in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago. Many of our passwords, he writes, are suffused with pathos, mischief, sometimes even poetry.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of amazing how much people could pack in these little 6, 8, 10, you know, character codes. If you got them talking, you know, out came these rich stories about, you know, everything from, you know, kind of an emotional scarring experience that they had many years ago that they decided to hold on to because they had lived beyond it, or sort of a joke with themselves, you know, at the boss's expense, or the name of the girl that broke their heart in high school, or a song lyric that helped them win the championship state championship swimming meet. You know, there were often really full stories in them. And it makes sense in retrospect because people chose them because they are emotionally charged. That's how they knew they would remember them.
Well, I would love the chance to go down a couple of the passwords that you discuss in your story, and I have a few of them here. The one that stands out is Jor-El. Now, I know that that's Superman's father. Somebody must love Superman, but does Jor-El password, does that password go deeper than just an affinity for comic books?
Yeah, so Jor-El is the password we find out that Jerry Seinfeld uses. It's really his ATM code. And in the show, it's testament to his love for Superman, and it's in the same episode that we learn about George Costanza's love for Bosco chocolate syrup.
Of course, I just remembered it, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, just tell me your code already. What is it?
I am not giving you my code.
I bet I can guess it.
Yeah, right.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Let's see. Well, we can throw out birthdays immediately. That's too obvious. And no numbers for you. You're a word man. All right, let's go deeper. What kind of man are you? Oh, you're weak, spineless, man of temptations. But what tempts you?
Huh?
You're a portly fellow. Headed long in the waistband. So what's your pleasure? Is it the salty snacks you crave? No, 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 no. Yours is a sweet tooth.
Out of here.
Oh, you may stray, but you'll always return to your dark master, the cocoa bean.
But what was riveting about Jor-El, as I dug in a little deeper, was that there are a lot of other resonances behind it. So Jor-El, you know, also connects to Jerry Seinfeld's personal life in that Jerry Seinfeld's father has the first name Kalman, and Kal-El was Superman's father. And we also learn that Kal is the middle name of Jerry Seinfeld's second child. And, you know, why does all this matter? It doesn't at the end of the day, but it did sort of have a certain beauty in its complexity and its loops. And it sort of, to me, showed that when you look into the codes that we embrace, they often have fascinating layers that sort of cross fact and fiction, future and past, you know, personal life and comic books.
Well, it's kind of fun to talk about Jerry Seinfeld, but you describe cases in which, you know, a parent dies and a daughter discovers that all of her mother's passwords are the name of her sister and not her. You have another password that's Lambda 1969. What's the story there?
So this was someone I happened upon at the park. This stranger told me that her son had committed suicide, and that after he committed suicide, she found his password written on a piece of paper at his desk, and it was Lambda 69. She got on the internet, as I think any parent would do, sort of curious to bring that person back to life and learn things they didn't know about them, perhaps. And she had no idea what Lambda 69 might mean, and the more she researched, the more she realized that Lambda was a very common historical gay symbol, often sort of connoting liberation, and 69 was a key date in gay history for the Stonewall riots. And the more she thought about that, the more she pieced together other realizations. She soon realized that her son was gay and had been for a long time, but she just hadn't known, and perhaps he hadn't felt comfortable telling her. So the point there was just that sometimes people stumble across the emotional baggage that is embedded in these passwords, almost inadvertently stumble across them.
These passwords are things that often we don't think about unless we're prompted for it. You probably don't go around during daily life thinking about your password at all unless the command prompt asks you for it. It's something that's small and something sort of unnoticeable, much like, you know, a pendant you would wear around your neck that you don't think about until, you know, you glance it in the mirror when you're getting out of the shower. But it still means something.
Yeah, it's also like a tchotchke in that in and of itself, it's not meaningful. It's a thing. It's often junk, you know, by any other definition. But because it corresponds with an important moment, it becomes important and you keep it over time. So I think that these passwords share those characteristics too.
Well, you know, Ian Urbina, it occurred to me in the online world and how we express ourselves there, you had, you know, Facebook updates, sort of a form of biography. Twitter, they even called originally microblogging, sort of a biography of yourself in 140 characters. It seems like the password now is the shortest autobiography of all.
Yeah, it's well put. I think there's this line in the piece that professor from Stanford mentioned, which was crypto haiku, which I thought was brilliant, you know, in that this is even more concise than haiku. It's often 6-10 characters long, and yet in there it's like a clown car. You open up the door and an impossible amount pours out.
Well, the password's job is to keep guard of secret worlds. That's what they're for, and that's what they do. But Ian Urbina has discovered that they do it in more ways than one. It's the meaning behind the passwords, the crypto haiku that's also hidden and has come out in his piece. Ian Urbina writes for the New York Times Magazine. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. This weekend, the Christmas Day release of the movie Selma opened to high praise and raked in big money at the box office. It's a film that depicts the 1965 voting rights march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, led by Dr. Martin Luther King.
We will not wait any longer. Give us the vote.
That's right. No more.
We're not asking, we're demanding. Give us the vote.
Give us the vote.
But our next guest says that that movie has glaring historical flaws and inaccurately represents an important time in the nation's history, in particular the role of President Lyndon Johnson in the march and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Joseph A. Califano Jr. was LBJ's top assistant for domestic affairs from 1965 to 1969. He was later named U.S. Secretary for Health, Education, and Welfare. Mr. Secretary, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be on with you again, Todd.
Now, you say that the film portrays LBJ as moving to intimidate and discredit Dr. King, and that Johnson only supported the Voting Rights Act for transactional reasons, for political reasons, and that he was against the march in Selma, and that all of that is wrong.
I think all of that is wrong, and the record is clear on that. There is a tape of the phone conversation between President Johnson and Dr. King on January 15th, 1965, available from the link to the LBJ Library, and it points out that Johnson's talking to King about how important voting rights is.
I think it's very important that we not to say that we're doing this and we not do it just because it's Negroes and whites, but we take the position that every person born in this country, when he reaches a certain age, that he have a right to vote, just like he has a right to fight. That we just extended, whether it's a Negro, whether it's a Mexican, who it is.
Joseph Califano, that's LBJ speaking to Martin Luther King.
That's right. And then he says, I want you to find the worst place you can run into in Alabama or Mississippi or Louisiana or South Carolina. And he said, get it in the pulpits, get it in the meetings, get every place you can. And then pretty soon, the fellow who didn't do anything but drive a tractor would say, it's not right, it's not fair. And that will help us. I quote, for what we're going to shove through Congress in the end.
Now, of course, Mr. Secretary, one of the issues here is that the movie Selma is a historical drama, not a documentary, so it takes some liberties. But it is true that the FBI did try to intimidate Martin Luther King, much of it before LBJ's term, and also it seems that J. Edgar Hoover was acting on his own, using agents to try to intimidate and discredit King. It's also true that the Kennedy administration was skeptical and reticent about the freedom marches a couple summers earlier during a Kennedy's administration. So it may not be true that Johnson did these things, but many of these things did happen in a way, and maybe the movie's taking some liberties with the dramatic aspects of history.
Let me say, the movie says, it's not just liberties. It's totally false what they say about Lyndon Johnson. My point was, the story is so dramatic, you don't have to tell these falsehoods in order to make it fly. And the reality is that Johnson wanted Selma. He wanted an event that would create and pique the national conscience. He talked about voting rights in 1964. He had a conversation with Everett Dirksen in 1964 on the day after he won the election, in which he said to Dirksen, I need you to help me break the filibuster because I'm going to propose a voting rights bill next year. And if you come with me and help break the filibuster, there'll only be two people in the state of Illinois that anyone in the United States will remember 100 years from now, and that'll be Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. When the law was passed, the first pen Johnson gave was to Everett Dirksen. The second pen he gave out was to Martin Luther King.
Joseph A. Califano Jr. was LBJ's top assistant for domestic affairs from 65 to 69. He was there correcting some of what he says are the historical falsehoods in the new movie Selma. Mr. Secretary, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Todd.
We definitely confirmed that the lander is on the surface.
Just the technological achievements alone.
One of the beliefs is that these comets were responsible for bringing much, if not all, of the water to our own planet.
Just to show that we can go to a comet, that we can orbit around it.
I can only hope that on landing day there were young kids watching who will now move their career to space science.
As we close in now on the end of 2014, we look back now at a remarkable year for space exploration and the historic moment for astronomy when Rosetta reached Comet 67P and successfully landed a probe called Philae right on its surface. Now, it was a mission 20 years in the making. Philae was able to land safely on the comet's surface after a seven-hour cold descent from its mothership. The dishwasher-sized robot's battery ran out of juice after its mission, but preliminary results from Philae's experiments on 67P taught us more about the origin of water on Earth than we have ever known before, and that's just the beginning. Fred Janssen is Rosetta's mission manager at the European Space Agency. For him, 2014 has been an emotional and scientific rocket ride, beginning with Rosetta waking up from hibernation in January to Philae's landing on 67P in November.
The year started with excitement and we ended with excitement. And now it was real tense. I mean, it had never been done, hibernating a spacecraft for 2.5 years. And it had to wake up autonomously. And then when it let us wait another few minutes additional to what we thought, that was breathtaking, I can say.
And with that signal came a huge 2014 for you and for all your crew, for all your colleagues, because it went from being, well, you know, let's be honest, pretty much under the radar of the world, basically ignored, not by everybody, but only the hardcore geeks even remembered that you had a mission. All of a sudden, 2014, you approach the comet, you orbit the comet, you landed on the comet, all with the world watching, you bounced off the comet. I mean, you sort of went from being, can I say, maybe in the eyes of the world, a nobody to being a rock star?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, of course, we have the wonderful looks of the comet help us a lot. This was not a boring, round piece of stone or whatever. Immediately, the first time we got images of it, it immediately looked strange. I mean, there was a bath duck, whatever comparison, a Klingon warbird. All the comparison were made immediately. And of course, also the involvement of social media is new in this business, but it really worked. And what is important, of course, in this business, you know, I'm 57. When I was young, I watched the landing on the moon from the living room, watching TV. And I can only hope that on landing day, there were young kids watching who will now move their career to space science, space operations, space business, and get to achieve what I have been privileged to see over the last year.
Well, Dr. Janssen, the mission is fantastic. Following it on YouTube is even better. But really, the science is the important thing, and we're not going to forget about that. Let's take a minute and talk about the most recent findings. You all published your first findings from sampling the water aboard 67P. Now, this was important because a lot of people theorize that the water on Earth may have come from comets. Now, my understanding is that the radioactive properties, the deuterium in the water on a comet, isn't the same as here on Earth. And now you're saying, no, the water on Earth probably didn't come from comets. How can we tell?
Well, that's a bit of a sharp turn. The water on Earth didn't come from comets like this exclusively. That doesn't mean that comets like this never impacted Earth. It means that globally, the population of comets which delivered, if comets were responsible, the population of comets which delivered water to Earth wasn't this one. And that's the interesting bit, because comets come in families. There is one family of comets which is called the Jupiter family. And there were two comets of this type, of which the deuterium to hydrogen ratio was known and to be compatible with Earth water. So now we've got 67P, where we measure this ratio, and it's three times higher than it is on Earth. That means that not all the Jupiter comets have the same pedigree, which in itself is interesting because that was one of the underpinning assumptions. And again, when I was giving my lecture today, I said to the people, well, you know, ticking off a box and saying, yeah, it's correct, this was it, That's one thing. But you now have the excitement of, hey, man, it's more difficult than we thought. And there are other things which could be wrong. So the search continues, and it may learn us a lot in a very different direction, namely the origin and the pedigree of comets and comet families is different than what we think.
Gosh, you know what I detect from you, Dr. Janssen? It's pretty amazing that in astronomy and science, a lot of times, being wrong is almost as exciting as being right, isn't it?
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, there were some of the greatest inventions started in testing an idea which proved to be wrong. And, well, you know, this is rocket science. It is exciting. You learn things about the origin of life, the universe, and you learn that some of the ideas which everybody assumed for 20, 30 years were right, apparently were not totally right and may even have been wrong all the way. So you can do something new. You throw away the old scrapbook and you start a new one.
So we've got some readings of Philae's sampling of the water on 67P. What's next scientifically? What's the next thing that we're going to see from the mission?
Okay, well, this particular result on the water, by the way, came from the Rosetta Orbiter, one of the instruments there. The results from Philae itself are being analyzed at the moment because, well, the scientific process takes time. You have to be careful and accurate. Well, one of the big things there is that, well, we did visit multiple places and we see differences between these places. So it's a blessing in disguise that we actually didn't land on just one spot. And yeah, what's next is that Rosetta itself is going to continue its journey alongside the comet, and it will become much more active in our approach to perihelion over the next 9 months. August next year is the closest approach point of the comet to the sun, when it will become really active, and Rosetta will be there to watch it. And on top of that, icing on the cake, again, we hope that the lander wakes up somewhere.
As it gets closer to the sun, gets more solar power pumping into the solar panels, it might get enough energy to wake up as the comet heats up.
Yeah, basically between now and June, July, the distance of the comet to the sun halves, which means that the amount of solar energy per square centimeter goes up by a factor 4. And that is exactly what we need to be able to start recharging the batteries.
Well, Dr. Fred Janssen, we're going to let you go. I know you're busy, but I want to just ask you, you know, New Year's Eve is coming up, 2015, just around the corner. You're going to go to sleep, I presume, at some point on New Year's Eve, the last night of 2014, and maybe look back a little bit. Sum it up, if you can. 2014 for you, what a year.
It's. I feel emotional as you were asking the question. It's been a very, very rewarding, but also a horribly difficult year. My life, my personal life, has been on hold for 18 months. And I really look forward to just having a family life again and being able to enjoy a successful project instead of continuously stressing over things which have to be corrected and managed and altered.
Dr. Fred Janssen, Mission Manager of Rosetta, you've earned it. Thank you for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Well, if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow, it's the year in food with Dan Pashman of The Sporkful.
Ramen everything. This has really gotten out of control. There's been a lot of hubbub, especially around the ramen burrito. There's also the ramen burger.
Call us with your favorite foods of the year, your favorite thing to eat, 8778-MY-TAKE. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.